as this child was growing up, the mother was the one who said, I think we got to go for help. I think there are learning problems, et cetera, et cetera. The father said, just come on. There's nothing wrong here. So what do we have at age 38? We have, if this, the father goes to work every day running a real estate business, the mother is home. The mother does not drive. The mother has anxiety. She's a captive at home. If he does not do what the mother says, he will attack the mother. Okay? The result of mother and father being on totally separate teams. So one of the things that we try to do is to, if mother's over here and father's over there, yeah, we try to meet in the middle somewhere. Now, it's real important that you understand that your child, whether the child is 5, 15, 27, 42, has defense mechanisms. If you go home and you expect the child to be reasonable, then you haven't learned anything from this seminar. But understand that when the child has been protected or been in their comfort zone, they're not going to say, thank you for helping me face my anxiety. Thank you for making me learn all these new things. They're going to rebel. You have two types of temper tantrums, basically. One is acting out behavior, getting aggressive. That can be verbal, emotional, physical. The other is a little more difficult. It's depressive behavior. The child can become more internalized, more withdrawn. This can be very hard for parents because what parents are thinking is, how much pressure can I put on my child? Will he or she have a nervous breakdown? Will he or she commit suicide? These are normal thoughts. You know, and this is one of the reasons that keeps the negative equilibrium or balance going on. So it's real important, again, coming back to that woman's question, that you know the individual chemistry of the child before you start putting pressure on. But if that child controls you through temper tantrums, that's a loosely interpreted concept, temper tantrums, and you are controlled by those temper tantrums, and you do not want to learn how to deal with them, and this is the crux of a lot of clinical work, then forget therapy, just do estate planning for the handicapped, because nothing will happen. And it is important, it is real important to for the parents to manage their own stress. All too often, children that we see, again, children of any age, think that their parents' only purpose on this planet is to take care of them. Parents have to manage their own stress. One of the things that we've seen is that the older the child is, the more the parents are susceptible to burnout. Burnout is exhaustion, emotional, physical exhaustion. The more burnt out you are, the more likely you will not be able to do what's necessary. But consider this. Here's another Oprah Winfrey story. I was watching Oprah Christmas time once, and they had different unique presents on. And this one guy invented a clock that was correlated to the average length of time in hours, minutes, and seconds that a person will live. So I think for a male in this society, it's 78. So imagine you're seeing a clock, and it's ticking right now. Tick, 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 tick. Hey, do it, though. It's real important. I had a client who is 30, father a doctor. Oh, this is what I mentioned before. Very, very disabled. I'm having a session with the parents alone. The father is 72 years old. The mother is 65 years old. We're talking about this really incredibly disabled young man. And the father says to the wife, what's your hurry? It blew my mind. I mean, I have a lot of amazing stories. You've got to learn what tough love means. Tough love does not mean that you're putting the kid out of the house. Tough love, don't mistake it for the stories you've seen on TV that's based on drug addiction and stuff like that. Tough love means there's consequences to behavior, and you have to be able to put them into effect. Responsibilities must be given. We had one person was age 16, 17, in the friendship group. Eliron takes this group on a trip. They do a lot of trips, and they go to a restaurant. And the bill comes. He spent $25 or $30 for lunch. He didn't have any money. He didn't have any money. He's 16, 17 years old. He did not have any money in his wallet to pay for lunch. Now, is this a learning disability? No, not necessarily. What this is, and I get locked into these discussions with the parents, tell us what to do, tell us what to do. We've done everything. The answer here was that, and they're very loving parents, but the answer here was that the parents operated with a profound lack of a sense of urgency. How else can a 16-year-old not know, that when you go to lunch and you get a check, you pay for it? People who are retarded with a 55-50 IQ know that. So this is emotional, cognitive, psychological learning. Gradual steps, giving responsibilities, a method of teaching. Again, activities of daily living. Here's another quick story. A 30-year-old, no friends, whatever, the whole syndrome of problems, comes into the program, is doing very well. He didn't want to come into the program, but his father facilitated it, came into the program, started making friends, had girlfriends, everything, had this girlfriend. He was in love with this girlfriend. He was having a great time. The girlfriend was over his house once. Just imagine, I mean, you know, your child, a lot of you are dealing with social problems, and here you have your first girlfriend, and it's going on 3 or 4 months, and it could be serious. They were talking marriage, whatever. She goes through his drawers and finds stained underwear. She broke up with him. Okay, was that a learning disability? Well, that's a learning disabled component, but what we have there is activities of daily living skills that were not taught to this person. You know, there's a profound message there, I think. You know, if the father had to get in the shower with the kid and teach him what to do, I mean, do you do it or you not do it? There are ramifications for everything. If there is confusion, and obviously there's a big tendency for confusion for diagnostics and learning disabilities, get yourself the right kind of testing. The action is, I don't want the child to think there's anything wrong with him, with either referring to LD or anxiety. If you don't know the reality, you have no chance to compensate. And obviously, you have to identify where to get appropriate help, which is, you know, a major piece of the puzzle. This theoretically is your answer. I'm not saying it's easy to follow, but at least you have part of your map when you leave here. Haley, one?
Well, it's all sound good and dandy. It's fantastic. I mean, I bet that you guys sit here and feel we learned something, we're probably going to make a change. And that is not so. I think because we ourselves have a lot of obstacles in a way to change that we are not aware of. And what I would like to present with you a little bit of those obstacles, so you know that you, as I do, we have them all. There are at least 3 or 4 obstacles. I'll talk about 2. Those of you who feel comfortable with me, just to play a game for a second, will you please be kind enough to cross your arms? As comfortable as you can.
What was the question again, Eleanor?
No question. Just cross your arms as comfortable as you can. Okay? Just let it go. Let it go again. Can you cross your arms in reverse, please? It's not impossible. Sometimes it's impossible. It's difficult. When I said cross your arms, you did it in a fraction of a second. And I said, in reverse. What's happened? Why you didn't do it as quick? Because we have to think about it. Because what? Because the first one is habitual. And guys, we are sitting here, and I think a lot of what we said here went into the habit compartment in your brain. It's not going to work. Habits is one of the biggest obstacles of doing therapy or helping other people. Even therapy sometimes, it's a habit. Okay? So ask yourself all the time, am I doing the same thing again and again? Jonathan, you said doing the same thing again and again and thinking that we might get different response. Well, that's number one. Change the way you think. Don't be habitual. Don't tell your child all the time, I want you to go to group. Or you must talk to your friends. Change it. Change it in one way or another. Make different statement. Create something. That's number one. Number two is we prejudge things. A lot of my group members will not come to a group. You know why? Because it's rainy. They want to come. But the parents say, hold on, that might create a car accident. And we cannot bear that. I'd rather you won't get what the group will give you today. However, you won't have a car accident. As if this car accident is going to happen definitely. which of course can happen tomorrow in not very rainy day. Okay, we prejudge a lot of things. We prejudge what our kids can do to a degree that we are enabling them more than you think. Again, in the very same group, I'm going to tell you one story that I'm ashamed of. Hey, I'll learn from my mistake. We went to the city, and there's a person, a 30-something years old man, the first time ever that he was in the group. We went to South Jet Seaport, and when we came back, please don't think that I'm a bad person, we did not bring them with us.
So, talk about anxiety, right?
So the mother was here, and she said, "And where is my Johnny?" And I said, "Oh, dear. Oh, he's probably in the city." And that was about 8 o'clock in the afternoon. She and I spent 6 hours or 8 hours in the police station. What the woman said is, "I want you to understand, he cannot even talk to other people. He is rubbing, at this point, he's dead." And listen, I didn't know the guy, and I said, "Oh my God, he's dead." At 3 o'clock in the morning, he got home. Let me tell you in detail what he did. He looked around. He saw nobody that he knows. He went to a police officer and asked him if there's any train station that can take him to the city, like to the train station he needs to go to Long Island. But somebody said yes, but he said, "Nah, let's take a taxi. I have enough money." He took a taxi to a Penn Station, never did before. Then he went and he did find the right train that take him home. And from the train station around 11 or 12 p.m., he walked home because he did not have enough money. And that is the guy that the mother said, he cannot even find his way in our house. He's sometimes confused where the bathroom is. Okay, so prejudging in this respect, oh, not to mention that I myself was disabled at this moment because I was not able to do anything. Okay, so prejudging is not a concept that we need to live with. It's number one. Two, three. How about we have fixed association. If I'll say, "Your child's going to get married," you say, "No." So your child can actually finish college. No way. No, he cannot. Okay, we have fixed association. And a lot of time we have first impression. You come to this group and you see the kids and say, "No, they're not good for us. Or they're too good for us." First impression. And think, when you guys are doing things for your children, think about those four concepts. Am I stuck with my first impression? Am I stuck with my habits? Am I stuck with the fact that I always prejudge things? That will help you to, I think, to be more creative at least. I'm trying very much to be creative in any form of therapy or whatever in my life. It's happened only because I do ask myself questions related to this issue. And then we go a little bit to self-esteem. As non-Native American, I allow myself sometimes the freedom of having typos. So I'll mistype this self-esteem. For me, self-esteem is self as team. Self as team. And most LD don't have any team with their self. There's a lot of parts. And each part does something else. The parents as well, responsible for the part that does something that they can or cannot do. So in my therapy, when I try to work with LD people, I'm trying to organize the self to be a team. You can do it too. You can ask your children a lot of time if their parts are together. Because if I want to turn right and I turn my wheel to the left, I'm not going to get nowhere. It will be a car accident. And they are prone to car accident every single day. Because they don't know. They don't know which part is not working or which part is not going the right way. We have to help them. That is self-esteem, by the way, for me. Self-esteem.
I think that's excellent. I want to just clarify one thing. This seminar was presented as a community service by the Friendship Connection, which is a nonprofit organization that I started 10 years ago as the professional consultant with a group of parents of LD kids. The Friendship Connection, very specifically, is, it's not therapy. It's therapeutic, descriptive adjective, groups for a specific functioning level of people, moderate level developmentally dash learning disabled. The work that you're hearing from these case stories and the work with the families and the biofeedback and all that kind of stuff, that comes from the therapy, which is something separate. Sometimes we combine the two. In the therapy, there are different groups too. We're getting back to functioning levels. One group we have has a number of corporate people, a lawyer, a medical student, high functioning, not necessarily learning disabled. They're there for social issues. That's my highest functioning group. And it goes down. And the key is you put people in groups where there are homogeneous, similar functioning levels. A lot of times, the group component of the therapy happens in the friendship connection. That's the laboratory. And we do the family work and the individual work around a lot of issues that do or do not happen here. So it's important to understand the difference there. We've covered a lot of ground. There's a lot more we could cover. You've been a good audience. We're going to stop now. We have about 10 minutes. Wait. But what I'm going to say is we have a few minutes for questions, and that's what we're going to do now.
Relating to what you just said, if a person's in group, are they also going to individual therapy? How does that work? I mean,
well,
how do you decide if they're in group or individual?
If a parent wants therapy, the mother and father come as a first step to see me. I do all the evaluations. Therapy. It is imperative that the parents buy my philosophy, that we work on the same team, etc. Then as part of therapy, I match the person up with a member of staff where they do the personal work on a one-to-one level. I am the therapist of the parents, and I integrate the child into that with family therapy as needed. The more resistant the person is, the more we need that. The more cooperative the person is, the less we need it. Okay, component one, individual therapy. Component two, the family therapy. Component three is the group. The group is dependent upon functioning levels and needs. If the functioning level is what is appropriate and what we have in friendship, I would use that as the group. If it was higher, I would have them come to a group in my practice. So it depends on what is needed. If a person has a moderate developmentally delayed a teenager or adult, and they do not want therapy, then they don't have to have therapy. They can just go to the friendship group. But this is where I want parents to be very clear on the expectations, because that will either make or break you. If the child comes into the group, even if the group is the right group, and they don't want to stay and you don't know how to handle that, you got a problem. But the group itself is a very important thing. There are plenty of people who come to the friendship group without being in therapy.
Yeah, you know, are there certain therapists that deal primarily with children?
Yes. Yes. Eliran, for example. You know, Eliran has a lot of people. The person comes from a weekly basis from Delaware and Philadelphia, you know, because there are, you know, people do searches on the internet. Where do we go for the learning disabled, the social anxiety stuff? There's not stuff around.
On the issue of the tough love, I have a daughter who's just started high school. She's resource room learning disabled. She tends to go for the friends that are the higher functioning and has tried to get into this group who are very, very nice to her, but only occasionally allow her to kind of take part in the outside school activities. At what point do I tell her, you know, you just aren't your type, you're more sophisticated, there, you know, what...
Well, I would put the responsibility back on her, first step. I'd try to activate her brain power. I would say, what do you think is going on? How do you feel? What's your evaluation of it? The one thing that you want to look for is you don't want to get the I don't know disease. Whenever you get I don't know, that's a door to open up to explore. That's where I would start. Yes? I'm sorry, what? No, if anybody's interested in the class, just speak to me individually. Yes?
You talk about natural approaches. You talked about St. John's Wort and Kava before. I've heard pycnogenol and grape seed extract is also very effective because it does pass over the barrier to the brain.
There's a lot of good stuff. It is very complicated. Give you a couple of examples. One of my patients in Texas, I do telephone therapy with, not learning disability, but social anxiety, recovering alcoholic, 5 years of sobriety. He doesn't want to take medication. He's depressed. He has anxiety. I say, take St. John's Wort. He takes it for 2 days. He's feeling great. Day number 3, 4, he starts getting headaches. Okay, so he then has to cut back and go on a lower dosage. You are putting something in your system. It is very hard to find. Eliran and myself are not experts in this natural pharmacology. We are somewhat aware of what's going on. It is very hard to find experts, but you are putting something in your body, and it's important to know what you're doing, and there's some stuff that works better than others. It's complicated stuff, but the way that I work, I think it makes sense sequentially to do the natural before you do the medication. One of the people, a physician that I very much respect, who is a medical nutritionist who's written a number of books, and I happen to be his patient, says that the best thing for anxiety-depression is something called inositol. All right, something new. Question?
Yes.
One last thing. So how do you feel about children who have ADHD on Ritalin?
It's a fact of life. Ritalin works wonderfully well for a lot of people. It depends on what your own value system is. How severe is the symptomatology? You know, how quick a sense of relief do you need? I mean, Ritalin, of course, it works in a lot of cases. It doesn't work in others. Is the person going to be on Ritalin forever? Is the person going to be on Prozac forever? You know, I mean, these are questions to real consider. What are your goals? By the way, that leads me into an important thing. If you're on medication, what's the goal? A lot of times people will get on medication for depression and anxiety, and they think that's enough. The way I think is that if they're not doing the underlying work at the same time, that therapeutic approach will reach the point of diminishing returns. And the theory should be that if you're not well enough to need medication, the purpose is to create a stronger structure in the body and loosening up of certain dynamics so the person's brain can function better to deal with the therapeutic issues. Yes?
What is the approach for grandparents to use to get the parents to work together? In our case, we have a grandson, a son-in-law, who totally opposes any therapy for our granddaughter. His statement is that all therapists are quacks.
You know, I have to tell, I have an answer for just about everything. But maybe not for this, because the reality is that it's the parents who should be here. It's the parents who should be here. And it's to your credit that you are here to research what this was. There's only one thing you can do. You can give them information. They can take that information and fly with it, or they can, you know, do what they've been doing.
Oh,
you have an answer?
Oh.
Go. All right, I knew I had your help.
I mean, the most important thing is the challenge. I think this son-in-law has a problem. Talk to him about his problem, not about your granddaughter's problem. He does have a problem, and he needs to work on it. And that's reality.
He threw us out of the house because I said our granddaughter was terrible.
Well?
The only way we see our granddaughter is our daughter brings it to us. Unfortunately, we live 20 minutes apart, so we see her at least once a week.
Which unfortunately makes my thoughts even stronger. In this respect.
Right, but the reality is there are some degrees of resistance that can't be overcome. Not, you know, that's a tough situation. Other questions? Yes.
Well, like I stated earlier, my son has had Ritalin and dexedrine, and the side effects overpowers, you know, anything that dexedrine is doing. He's capable of being in class and everything. But that's why we're here. Because the medication, the side effects is making things worse. Went to the doctor, she said he lost 4 pounds. He doesn't want to eat.
Well, in a situation like that, my answer is you need a really holistic systems approach, which means the nutritional factor is important, the behavioral management is important, and in a case like that, when you're concerned about the side effects, I have to say the EEG biofeedback is the best thing available.
Yes.
Of course, and one of the most powerful things is common sense, you know, but there's a tremendous lack of it. Listen, you've been a very good audience.
I you said before. I need to leave it as a thought of mine. A little bit
impulsive here today.
I in fact do like research, so I was involved in research. There's a beautiful research done with flies because we try to learn about ourselves and our behavior from different animals. So fly, even, we can learn. So we take, the research was taking flies and put them into a jar. I think we all did it when we were younger for different purposes, but that was a research. So you take about 100 flies and you put them in a jar, and you just put the top over there, and the fly are getting crazy. They want to get out, and they cannot. And you look at the jar again after 20 minutes, and what you find that some of them already gave up, and they are on the floor. They cannot do no more. And most of them are stuck to the glass, looking at the world from a very, very new position. They are stationary, looking at the world from inside out. And then you say, okay, so let's see what we can do if we open the jar. What they're going to do? What do you think the fly do when we open the jar? What they do?
They stay where they were.
They stay. Why? We open the jar. They wanted to open. They wanted to fly. We open the jar and they don't move. And I believe that most of our LD are exactly the same. In the beginning of their life, they tried everything like everybody else, and you as a parent too. We tried everything to be like everybody else, and somebody, some power, took us and put us in a jar. We tried to fight, and we exhausted. And all of our kids is looking from in outside. The world is outside, and I'm stationary. Very difficult to move. And we say, guys, the jar is open. Fly.
Which brings us to the perfect concluding story, which is...
Oh, I didn't know there was a perfect concluding. Well, there's one of this.
I had this wonderful quote I saw for the first time a few weeks ago, and I'm sure some of you have seen it. It said, the mark of good parenting is to give your children roots to grow and wings to fly. And when you've got problems of the socially handicapped, the roots are probably strong, but the wings are pretty weak. In the back, there are envelopes of information for everybody. There are a few copies of my book if anybody wants to purchase it. There are a couple of copies of a TV program that are available if people, you know, are so inclined. But thank you for coming, and I'll be around for a few minutes if anybody has any questions.